As the leaders of the G20 gather in Japan, a new report reveals that it's not just the US and China that are distorting world trade. So can the world's largest countries quit their addiction to protectionism? Welcome to Vox Talks from the Center for Economic Policy Research. My name is Tim Phillips. In the last few weeks, Vox Talks has talked a lot about trade wars, but the 24th Global Trade Alert that's just published by the CEPR Press points out that the rot set in on world trade long before this current feud. Fixing world trade's on the agenda of this year's G20 meeting, which takes place on 28th and 29th of June, but what to do? So today we're having our own little mini-summit. Well, it's me and Simon Evenett, Professor of International Trade at the University of St. Gallen. He's a research fellow at the CEPR, and he's one of the authors of the Global Trade Alert. Simon, welcome to Vox Talks.
Great to talk to you.
In recent weeks, Simon, we've been talking to Chad Bown and Meredith Crowley, amongst others, about what's going wrong at the WTO. But you seem to be making the case in this report that this is just a symptom of the global tilting of the playing field, I think you called it, that's been happening for a decade or more. Can you give some examples of what's going on?
So everyone knows about the trade war with President Trump raising tariffs on the Chinese and the Chinese raising tariffs back. And I think that resonates because of both the scale of it and the historical parallels to the 1930s. But what many people don't know is that over the past 10 years, there's been many other much more subtle below the radar screen forms of protectionism which have gone unnoticed. I'll give you some examples. Perhaps the biggest is the scaling up of export incentives given by the Chinese government to their firms at the beginning of the crisis, which was a major increase in support for their exporters. Another type of trade distortion we've seen is in the area of subsidies. At the beginning of the crisis, it was all the rage to give firms that were supporting so-called green growth subsidies. Now the rage is to give lots of money to firms which are supporting batteries, the next generation of IT equipment, 5G and alike. And so there's been a shift in subsidization in industries which are very, very open to international competition, and that distorts trade as well. And then there's some other types of trade distortions which get a lot of attention from time to time. You may remember Buy America at the beginning of the crisis got a lot of attention. Lots of countries have copied Buy America in different forms around the world in the 10 years since. Instead of having some big spasm of protectionism like we saw in the 1930s with the Smoot-Hawley tariff being passed, instead you've had the accumulation of thousands and thousands of trade distortions. And essentially, this has thoroughly distorted world trade. We have a system now where essentially trade is nominally open, but heavily distorted. And the trade war has really made explicit what has been implicit over the past 10 years.
When you look at it from this angle, then it's remarkable how few of the distortions come from the US and China. This has been a distraction, hasn't it, to what you're saying is really going on in the background?
Yes, let me say two things there. I mean, first, the US and China have been quite active in contributing to this build-up of thousands and thousands of smaller measures. But when it comes to the last couple of years, and this is my second point, I agree that trade war is a distraction from what has really been going wrong at the trading system more generally. Obviously, we have to somehow persuade the Americans and the Chinese to step back from the confrontation that they have happening, and hopefully that will happen in Osaka at the G20 summit. But the reality is that a lot of countries have been crossing the line on protectionism, and there's a real case for a global initiative to pull back or roll back protectionism.
So even if the US and China do step back, we can't congratulate ourselves that we've solved the problem here. How big is the total effect on world trade? Can you give us a back of the envelope calculation on this?
Certainly I can. But let me start off by agreeing with you, which is that I think we could end up there if we did solve the US-China trade war, or rather if those governments solved it, it would be a small victory compared to the bigger issue of getting rid of the crisis era protectionism. Now let's talk about the scale of protectionism since you asked about it. We estimate that in May of this year, 2019, over 70% of world trade is affected by trade distortion, which is in force in May 2019.
Wow.
Okay. So it's not stuff which has lapsed. And that percentage has progressively grown. It shot up in 2009, mainly because the Chinese put in place a whole series of export incentives. And then as other countries copied and did these other forms of protectionism that I told you about, it has progressively risen to higher and higher shares of world trade. So this is a first order problem for the trading system.
70% is a huge figure, isn't it?
It is a huge figure. And it points to one thing where I think many analysts, many policymakers have gone wrong is people equate trade distortions with the tariffs of the 1930s. Mm. And when they didn't see the huge tariff increases of the 1930s, they gave themselves a pat on the back and said, phew, we dodged that bullet. But as any well-trained economist should know, there are plenty of ways to distort international markets. You can have export subsidies. You can have all sorts of hidden import restrictions. And this is what countries have resorted to. The real lesson here is we had a global economic crisis and the form of trade distortions changed from the 1930s one to much more below the radar screen measures and measures also that promoted exports rather than restricted imports.
And so to the G20, it takes place on the 28th, 29th of June, or for people who are listening to this podcast later, it took place on the 28th and 29th of June. We all know that in these meetings, leaders often pay lip service to reform, but without getting really involved. And there's quite a lot going on in the world that's not to do with trade at the moment. So how far up the agenda really is removing protectionism for the G20 this year?
My sense is that it'll be a sort of middle level issue. It'll be raised by some of the more free trading nations as being a big concern for them. So I wouldn't be surprised if countries like Canada, Germany, the UK made it one of the speaking points for their government heads. Mm. But I think it will be on the agenda. The signals are that the Japanese government, who's organizing, of course, this summit, is trying to put peer pressure on the Chinese and the Americans to step back and to think again about what they're doing. And this is quite an interesting approach. We had not expected the Japanese to be so, not so much aggressive, but proactive in this respect. And I think it may have surprised both the Chinese and the Americans to come under such pressure. But I suspect ultimately what will happen is President Xi and President Trump will get together. There'll be some type of choreography around a meeting. Hopefully the meeting doesn't blow up and there'll be lots of smiles and all sorts of talk about trying to come to a trade deal soon. Of course, that doesn't solve any of the underlying negotiating problems and complexities, but at least it'll look like the leaders are talking and some people will take a comfort in that.
How much really gets done at these summits? As you say, the leaders can get together and make a statement, but that's a couple of hours. And as you say, this has been building up for 10 years. So is that just a signal for people, firing the starting gun for people to get on with doing something about this?
I think there's something in what you say. I mean, I think in the area of trade, the G20 has actually accomplished very, very, very little. I know the supporters of the G20 would dislike that assessment. I think if you're going to make the case for the G20, you could point to the fact that in 2008 and 2009, when things were looking really scary, getting these leaders together in the room and them all looking each other in the eyeballs and saying, we're not going to do anything stupid, probably was important. And secondly, in the area of financial regulation, where there has been quite a lot of reform and cross-border talk, actually having a series of regular deadlines where stuff has to be presented to the presidents and prime ministers of leading countries, I think also focuses the minds of their senior officials. So that's a pat on the back as far as the macroeconomics and the financial regulation side is concerned. On the trade side, to be frank, it's an abject failure.
Let's be specific about this. You've called reform efforts in your report a free-for-all with little sense of strategic or, for that matter, historical perspective. Are they really that bad?
Yes, I think when it comes to WTO reform, the governments, or more importantly, their ambassadors in Geneva and trade officials back home have been floundering for a number of years. Mm. They managed to come together to do a small agreement on the customs houses reform in Bali a few years ago. But since then, the pressure has been off. And now the pressure is back on for them to deliver some results. And essentially, we saw in their last WTO ministerial conference in December of 2017, a whole scramble of initiatives being put on the table. And really, countries were all acting, I think, very much on what they thought might be of interest to them. But no one was stepping back and saying, wait a minute, we need to put together a package here, which keeps a lot of the membership on board. And so we don't just help the countries which are interested in electronic commerce. We also think about countries which might have other interests. And that type of systemic perspective, I think, has been missing. And instead, you have a whole series of sort of uncoordinated initiatives being pushed forward. And by the way, often with very little evidence to back them up. And this is not evidence-based policymaking by any stretch of the imagination. And what we wanted to do in this Global Trade Alert report was actually to say, look, we have the data and the information, as does everyone else. Why don't you sit back and ask, where could you put together coalitions of countries which are willing to go ahead and reform certain sectors of the world economy? And instead of having multilateralism, have minilateralism with a small number of sectors being liberalized at the same time. So in that sense, we wanted to shift the debate away from the rather ad hoc approach to something which was a bit more data-driven.
Yes, tell me a little bit more about what you're calling evidence-driven reform. How does this work? What evidence are we bringing into play here?
First, you've got to define what type of agreements you're going to compare. So we looked at all the manufacturing sectors and asked, if you took each one or combinations of them and you rolled back that 10 years of protectionism that we talked about earlier in this interview, which countries would gain from this and which countries would lose? And the data then you need to do that is to obviously the underlying trade flows and the evidence of the buildup of protectionism over the last 10 years. What do? You basically simulate to see which countries' exports rise more than their imports. What's the balance between the gain in exports and an increase in imports, and then figure out which countries are likely to support an agreement in a particular sector. So you start off looking at one sector after the other. And there we found there's only one sector in the world economy where 80% of world trade would be covered by a sectoral deal. And that's called special purpose machinery. That's a fancy trade term for medical equipment and research equipment. So if you look at just a single sector, you get that one. If you look at combinations of sectors, you can liberalize much more trade. So we found, for example, that if you were to combine liberalization of the base metals sector, man-made fiber sector, and transport equipment sector, then that's a deal which would benefit 76 members of the World Trade Organization, including all the big players, and would reform $1.5 trillion worth of trade, which is a big number. So that's the type of sort of systematic comparison across options which hasn't been done today and which we did in the 24th Global Trade Alert report. And we hope that this will help put the debate on where the WTO can go forward on a much more factual grounds. Rather than countries speculating about whether they can win or lose, they can actually look at the underlying evidence.
And this makes it possible to eat the elephant of reform one bite at a time by being able to fix this amongst yourselves and you will all benefit.
The mode of operation here is you find a group of sectors which you think are particularly ripe for reform. Then you find a coalition of the willing who would support reform there. And then the form it takes at the WTO is those countries that reform their trade policies, and everyone who's a member of the WTO benefits. So this is called a critical mass agreement in the term of the WTO. And there are other countries who can free ride. But if it turns out there are enough countries which gain from an agreement, then the negotiating art is to try and get those countries to join in and not to sit out the accord.
In some ways, this helps solve that problem that you set out, the paradox that everyone wants to reform world trade, but they want to reform world trade in a way that benefits them so they look good at home.
Part of it is that we developed a culture over the last 20 years of trade reform, which is that trade reform is good as long as everyone else does it. So I think governments have got to realize that you have to pay to play. And if countries are not prepared to pay, then they won't see this organization going forward. And so with a bit of minilateralism that we just talked about, reforming one, two, three sectors at a time, hopefully we reinstill this basic point that this is a case of give and take. And you do have to give before you can take.
Does this mini reform need a leader, a figurehead, someone who will knock heads together?
Well, it normally needs someone to bring people together. In the old days, the Americans were the ones who used to knock heads together, and they were extremely good at it. Then, of course, with the current administration, that's not going to happen. So instead, we're looking, I think, to middle-ranking powers. You know, we might have thought the EU could play this role, and I think they might be predisposed towards doing it. But I suspect it will probably be the middle-sized free-trading nations like your Canada's, Australia's, possibly the UK when it leaves the EU, which would be the ones pushing for this. But again, it can't be an Anglo-Saxon-pushed initiative. This has got to be global and it's got to be inclusive. So you're going to have to find other countries like Chile, Mexico, South Korea, who've traditionally promoted trade reform, to get them on board as well.
Can the WTO be saved? Or is it just something that we're going to say, well, it did all right for 25 years, but it outlived its usefulness?
I think the WTO can be saved, but I don't think it's in any way a certainty. And by the way, it won't die. These international organizations never die. They just sort of go into hibernation. They become like zombies. So I think the will in certain countries is there. I think the incentive is there. And hopefully that's what our report shows is it's not just a matter of nice words. There's real money on the table for countries who want to engage. And then what we're going to do is to get enough like-minded governments to see that this is the way forward. And the great thing about the approach that we were putting forward, which others have argued for as well, is that you don't need to bring everyone on board to take the WTO forward. You can have coalitions of the willing who move ahead at a faster speed than the rest of the membership. And that is what could be the next wave of WTO reform.
Well, we look forward to that. Simon, thank you.
Thank you very much.
As ever, the news from the G20 will probably be dominated by personalities and politics. If you want to dig deeper, the 24th Global Trade Alert is eye-opening. It's packed with data, that evidence base that Simon was talking about. Unlike the communique from a diplomatic summit, it names names and it recommends specific ways we can fix this problem. So I'd recommend you go to FuxEU and read George Orr, Not War, War, Prioritising WTO Reform Options. That's the column by Simon and Johannes Fritz. And you'll find a link there that you can click on to download the report. This has been a Vox Talk from the Centre for Economic Policy Research. Subscribe on your podcast platform for a new episode every Friday, or dig into our archive at www.voxeu.org/vox-talks.